a weekly show that aims to address the most significant issues in the South Asian region. And in this program, we will discuss the G20 summit in India and also Muhammad Ali Jinnah, a leader who promoted Muslim unity. So stay tuned.
In this special episode of the subcontinent, we will discuss conflicting interests among G20 nations. And we shall also take a look at Muhammad Ali Jinnah as a Pakistani leader who stood for Muslim unity.
Skirmishes are not new in the G20. For long, the world has been witness to the clashing interests between the member states of the group, the Russia-Ukraine conflict being the latest issue of disagreement. In a meeting of the G20 nations this year, the fishes in the group were quite clear when it failed to issue a joint statement on the Russia-Ukraine conflict as the member states tussled over their differences on the issue. In this scenario, India's role as the host of the G20 this year seems challenging.
Peeping into the past, the differences in the G20 group have been quite apparent. During the COVID-19 pandemic, the rich nations in the G20 group, especially Germany and the UK, had rejected the proposal of India and South Africa for wider vaccine production, thus endangering the life of billions of people worldwide. The group is also divided on the issues of global trade and climate change. The former US President Donald Trump had officially withdrawn from the Paris Agreement on climate change.
There are many other examples, but the bottom line is that the Paris Accord is very unfair at the highest level to the United States.
According to experts, G20 is an amalgam of countries from global south and north with diverse interests where the rich global north forwards policies for its own benefits. Analysts say that these summits are just photo opportunities for presenting a friendly image. The reality is that the group is deeply divided and cannot achieve anything practical.
As India is playing host to this year's G20 meetings, many NGOs have slammed the G20 for ignoring the real problems of the developing countries. Voicing a truly sustainable, democratic, equitable and just economies and societies, various human welfare organizations have said that the world cannot be deceived by the gimmicks of some wealthy countries which have been promoting policies exploiting the global south to meet their vested interests.
Non-governmental organizations have pointed that instead of raising world problems like climate crisis, poverty, hunger, malnutrition, and socio-economic inequalities, the grand scale of G20 summits portray a shiny picture of the world, giving a false notion that all is well. Experts have been raising their voice against the neoliberal policies and authoritarian governance pushed ahead by forums like the G20, claiming that these policies are detrimental to the progress of developing countries. Many organizations have also been criticizing the Indian government's action of displacing the homeless people to far-flung areas and removing street vendors from the roadsides to beautify the cities for the scheduled G20 meetings, regarding it as a farce used as a cover to hide the reality.
Now, to have more insights on this, we are joined by former Indian ambassador and former advisor to the Indian National Security Council, Mr. Pankaj Saran from New Delhi. First of all, welcome to the program, Mr. Saran.
Thank you very much for having me. I'm very happy to be with you. Thank you.
Us too as well. Thank you, sir. Now, let's begin with the G20 group of countries. It's an amalgam of nations with a conflicting interests right now. So what purpose does this group serve when the member countries do not share the common goals?
Well, thank you very much. I had the privilege of attending the first few meetings of the G20 summit starting from 2008. And it was basically a self-selected group, which was created at very short notice after the Western economic and financial crisis. And I remember at that time, the president was George Bush, and he invited India to join. So in the first couple of years, the group actually played a very useful role in the sense that they came up with emergency measures, both on the financial side, on the fiscal side, the monetary side. They were actually taking, coordinating actions by central banks. They were coordinating capital flows. If you remember, the stock markets had collapsed. Basically, 2008 was a collapse of the capitalist economic system. So at that time, the G20 came to the rescue, in a sense, of the G7. And at that time, China was the bright spot because it was the only economy that was growing fast and was not did not suffer from the contagion effect of the crisis. Since then, the G20 has evolved, its agenda has expanded, and many new issues have come into the G20, including health, social sector, education, skill, labor, environment, etc. So the G20, as you say rightly, is not a homogeneous group, but it was intended to represent the 20 most significant global economies. And over time, the G20 has played a role, but its role also depends on the state of the global economy. So today, I think the main job of the G20 is to see how we can revive global growth, how we can restore confidence in the markets, because the fact is that the advanced economies, the United States and the Eurozone, are almost flat in terms of growth. China's growth rates have come down to from earlier higher rates to maybe 4% or maybe 5%. So the global economic outlook is not very bright. So the G20, we have to see whether it can actually provide the solutions. So yes, at one level, it does not have a homogeneous character because they come from different regions, different political systems, different ideologies. But on the other hand, they do represent the bigger economies. And in a sense, you can say it is an expansion of the G7 because it includes China, India, some other countries, Russia, etc. So I would put it like this, that it has its use, it has its utility, but there are differences, both with regard to, let us say, capital flows, interest rates, the reforms of the multilateral development banks, the role of Bretton Woods institutions such as the IMF and the World Bank. There are differences even, for example, on how to meet the climate change challenge.
Yes, sir, Mr. Saran. Yes. Mr. Saran, sorry to cut you off. Many are saying the global north has been guarding its own interests without taking into consideration for the developing countries or issues of the developing countries in the group. So what do you think about the exploitation of the global south?
You know, India hosted a big summit of 125 countries earlier this year called the Voice of the Global South. And we felt very strongly about it because we felt that the voice of the global south was not being heard, especially after the Ukraine conflict. So yes, there is a historical legacy we have of exploitation during the colonial era by the richer countries over the poorer countries. And we have talked about that. But it is because of that that India has tried to bring the agenda and the issues of concern to the south onto the G20 table. So I agree that this is a problem. But India is trying to work with partners to correct this imbalance.
That's what I said. You've mentioned the climate change. I can also say trade, the COVID-19 vaccine, the patent, or a few of the issues that have divided the group in the recent past. Presently, the Russia-Ukraine war is a cause of conflict amongst the members. So my question would be, are the skirmishes within the G20 going to increase, or they are going to solve these problems or these issues amongst themselves?
You know, it all depends on the degree of mutual trust and the degree of political will. On climate, for example, the same set of countries, in fact, a bigger set, had taken commitments in Copenhagen in 2009, in the Paris Agreement in 2015, that a certain amount, $100 billion, would be transferred every year till 2020 and extended till 2025 to the developing countries to help them to meet climate change challenges in terms of financing of technologies and mitigation adaptation. This target has not been met. So we are going to raise this issue. On trade, what we are saying is we need equal market access. We need to reduce barriers to trade. We need to have a level playing field. On vaccines, you are right, because we tried very hard in the WHO and in the WTO when it came to the generic drugs and vaccines to make them available to Africa and to all other poorer countries. But we did not succeed.
Okay, sir. Mr. Saran, before we let you go, what do you expect from the upcoming G20 summit?
I think I don't expect any one single outcome, given the nature of the global economy and the global political situation. But I certainly expect a bunch of four or five main outcomes which deal with the primary challenges of today. And these would include, for example, ensuring peace, ensuring equity and stability in the global financial and economic order, some strong recommendations on climate change, on access to technology, on how we can bridge the gap between the rich and the poor in the world. I would also expect to see, hopefully, a reduction in political tensions as a result of this summit.
There you have it, former Indian ambassador and former advisor to Indian National Security Council, Mr. Pankaj Saran from New Delhi. Now, let's see what people have said on social media.
Alec Russell, foreign affairs editor at Financial Times, posted, "The G20 should not be a divided house. India's top negotiator, John Reed, writes, ideally, yes, but no amount of emollient words will bridge some fundamental divisions. The post-financial crisis order is crumbling and it's unclear what's next. Can't stand hypocrisy," ex-page against propaganda-based media posted. "Three reasons G20 is losing. It's thunder to an expanding BRICS, the real game in town. The Global South members are frustrated that the US NATO bloc tries to hijack every meeting. Look at Bali, big divisions between Global South and NATO bloc. Z has zero desire to meet Biden." Katalia from Hyderabad, India posted, "G20 is hopelessly divided. G20 Summit 2023 will be dominated by the West. The prospect for a joint communique appears dim. Both Putin and Xi giving it a miss and deeper divisions over Russia's war in Ukraine. Food security, debt distress, global cooperation on climate change." Andy Vermoot, a journalist from Belgium, posted, "Ukraine war, absence of Putin and Xi set to dent G20 summit. Deeper and more entrenched divisions over Russia's war in Ukraine risk derailing progress on issues such as food security, debt distress and global cooperation."
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent here on IRIB English Radio.
Muhammad Ali Jinnah, the Muslim leader of Pakistan, worked for unity amongst the Muslims of South Asia and also the world. He stressed on the need of cohesion in the Muslim population, forwarding a policy of cooperation between different Muslim countries around the globe. The founder of Pakistan envisioned the newly formed country to promote Muslim intellectuals, leading to Islamic Renaissance. Advocating freedom for all Muslims struggling against colonial powers, Jinnah desired to build an Islamic bloc based on social justice.
In his historic speech in Lahore in 1940, Jinnah said, "It has been my constant endeavor to try to bring about unity among the Muslims. We Muslims believe in one God, one book, and one prophet, peace be upon him, so we must stand united." Jinnah focused on the emancipation of Muslims all over the world and wished Muslim countries to be powerful enough to stand against all forms of subjugation. The Pakistani leader supported the North African Arabs in their struggle against the French rule. He also provided assistance to freedom movements in Indonesia, Libya, and Morocco. Many experts believe that unity of Muslim world was Jinnah's ultimate objective, and the creation of Pakistan was a step towards realizing this dream.
As the most important issue for Muslims around the globe, Jinnah's support for Palestine was unwavering. Voicing his disdain for the establishment of a Jewish homeland in Palestine, the Muslim leader announced that the partition of Palestine would be the gravest disaster in human history. Jinnah regarded the formation of the Zionist state as unjust and cruel and pledged to help the cause of the Arabs of Palestine in every possible way.
Muhammad Ali Jinnah protested several times against the change in British policy towards the Jews in Palestine. In his address to the Muslim League in 1937, the founder of Pakistan stated that Britain has dishonored its proclamation to the Arabs, which guaranteed them complete independence of their homelands. He added that Britain will be digging its grave if it fails to honor its proclamation of safeguarding the rights of Arabs. Providing support to the Supreme Arab Council, he is credited with opening the Palestine Fund to raise money for Palestinian families affected by the conflict. After the approval of Palestine's partition plan by the United Nations in November 1947, Jinnah conveyed his disapproval to the American President Truman, warning him from partitioning the state of Palestine. Since Israel's unlawful creation in 1948, Pakistan has not recognized the Zionist regime and continues to be faithful to the ideology of its founder.
Now, to have more insight on this, we are joined by former Federal Minister for Planning, Development, Reforms and Special Initiatives, Mr. Asad Umar from Islamabad. Mr. Umar, welcome to the program, sir.
Thank you.
You're more than welcome. Now, sir, Muhammad Ali Jinnah augmented for Muslim unity. Several of his lectures have reinforced this desire. So my question is, in what way did he work to fulfill his wish of putting a united Muslim front?
So you're absolutely right. Qaid-e-Azam, as we call him, Jinnah Sahib's struggle was all about Muslim unity, first and foremost for the Muslims living in the subcontinent and ensuring that they get their rights and homeland of their own, but also across the Muslim world, having unity amongst all Muslim countries. And as a result, you saw the Pakistani foreign policy shaped by Mr. Jinnah's vision right from day one, being about reaching out to all other Muslim countries, standing by them in their hour of need, and also supporting them at all international fora. And that was all driven by the vision of our founding father, Mr. Muhammad Ali Jinnah, because he believed that the only way the Muslims could get the rightful place in the world was by being united and putting up a united front for their cause, as some of the other blocs like the Soviet or the communist bloc at that time and the Western world were united in promoting their cause.
Sir, experts say the formation of Pakistan was just a start towards larger Muslim unity and not an end. So how do you see the creation of Pakistan as a step in the direction of unity amongst Muslims around the world?
You're absolutely correct. The political struggle was led by Qaid-e-Azam Muhammad Ali Jinnah, and the ideological underpinning was provided by a close friend of Mr. Jinnah, Allama Iqbal, and in his famous words, "Ek ho Muslim haram ki paasbani ke liye, Neel ke sahil se leke tabakha ke kashgar." In other words, he wanted to see all Muslims united from the shores of the Nile River to the lands of Kashgar and everything in between. And the whole idea was that we promote our unity, and through that, the welfare and the well-being of the people living in Muslim lands. And it was that thinking which drove Pakistani policy, even when with the creation of the Organization of Islamic Countries, and Iran also played an important role at that point in time. Pakistan was one of the big movers for creating the Organization of Islamic Countries. Unfortunately, it has not been able to fulfill the potential for which it was created. But that desire still lives on amongst the people of Pakistan to see the unity amongst the Muslim countries in the Muslim world.
Like you said, sir, you've also mentioned Iran. Now, Mr. Jinnah focused on the emancipation of Muslims. As we've seen, Iran is working on cooperation between Muslim countries. So how do you see Iran's progress?
I think Iran has surprised the world with the difficult challenges that Iran has faced over the last few decades. Its ability to continue to grow and prosper, to secure itself against external challenges, both in terms of a war imposed on it through aggression, but also through sanctions and all kinds of international pressure that has been brought upon it. And Iran has shown in many ways the way to live independently, to be a Muslim country which is proud of its heritage, which is founded in its beliefs in its religion, and at the same time able to function in the modern world. And the people of Pakistan also draw inspiration from that. And as neighbors, as brotherly neighbors, we've always had very, very close relationships. And that relationship with Iran continues to be one of the strong foundations of Pakistani foreign policy.
That's right, sir. I also wanted to for you to talk about Palestine as well. The founder of Pakistan showed unwavering support to the Palestine cause, saying that he can go to any lengths for the people of Palestine. So how important is the issue of Palestine for present-day Pakistan?
You're absolutely right. It was a very, very important issue for the founder of Pakistan, for the founding fathers of Pakistan, and it continues to be an important part of Pakistani foreign policy. There have been arguments made to us by other countries, including some of the Muslim countries, of the need to get better relationships with Israel. And fundamentally, it's not a question of being anti anyone. It's a question of standing by the rights of the people of Palestine. It's a cause for the Muslim world, but it goes beyond the Muslim world. Anybody who believes in humanity, anybody who believes in human rights, anybody who believes in the right of people of self-determination, for them, causes like Palestine and Kashmir will be causes that they will support, regardless of whether they're Muslims themselves or not.
There you have it. Former Federal Minister for Planning, Development, Reforms and Special Initiatives, Mr. Asad Umar from Islamabad. And that was our episode on the G20 and the conflict between its member states, and also Muhammad Ali Jinnah as a visionary Muslim leader in Pakistan. Now, we shall meet again, same time, same day, next week. So till then, take great care.
A diverse range of programs. Youth. Spirituality. Culture. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
A study shows that lead exposure has killed more than 5 million people in the world in just 1 year. Contamination from battery recyclers, tainted cookware, and fertilizers could be contributing to the health crisis. Regarding this issue, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. According to Grist, there is no safe level of lead. The naturally occurring metal is so toxic that the Environmental Protection Agency began banning its use in paint and gasoline in 1970s, following the lead of other countries. Since then, a growing body of research has confirmed the health effects of lead exposure, including heart and kidney diseases. The effects are particularly pronounced in children. Exposure to lead in the first 5 years of life has been shown to hinder brain development, stunting a child's ability to learn, focus, and control their impulses. A new study from the World Bank tallies the staggering worldwide toll, says 5.5 million deaths from heart diseases because of exposure to lead in 2019 alone. Researchers also found that exposure to lead in children under 5 years old led to a loss of more than 750 million IQ points, a standardized measure of intellectual ability. People in low and middle income countries, where blood lead levels are higher on average than in high income countries, were hit hardest. The overall cost of exposure was $6 trillion in 2019, the equivalent of nearly 7% of the world's economic output. Jorn Larsen, a consultant with the World Bank and lead author of the study, said, "There has been this idea that since the phase-out of lead in gasoline in 1970s, the problem has more or less been solved. Our estimate indicates that the health effects and the cost of lead exposure is possibly as large as the health effects and cost of fine particulate, ambient air pollution, and household air pollution combined. That is enormous." The study published in the journal Lancet Public Health recently relied on blood lead level estimates in a 2019 study that aggregated data sources on health and morality outcomes worldwide. Larsen and his co-author then used existing research on the effects of lead to calculate IQ loss in children and deaths from cardiovascular diseases in adults. They also estimated the economic cost of the loss in IQ and deaths. The findings were surprising, Larsen said. IQ losses were about 80% higher, and the number of deaths from cardiovascular disease was six times higher than previous estimates. Larsen attributed the difference to improvements in the understandings of the effects of lead exposure and a more comprehensive methodology that better captured how exposure could cause cardiovascular diseases. In low- and middle-income countries, the researchers found that the average is still about 4.6 micrograms per deciliter, which Larsen said drove the findings on IQ loss and cardiovascular disease. There are many factors causing higher levels of blood lead levels in lower-income countries. Lead battery recycling units may contaminate the air, water, or soil in and around population centers. Aluminum pots and pans might be tainted with lead that eventually leaches into food. Leaded paint is also still used in many countries, and lead has been found in phosphate fertilizers, which could be contaminating crops. It's unclear which of these sources are driving elevated levels of blood in lower-income countries. Larsen said that government and aid organizations should routinely test children to get better understanding of lead exposure, and that, in turn, could help identify hotspots and potential sources of the toxic metal. Larsen said, "The understanding of these sources is very incomplete. We are decades behind on lead because it has been a neglected area up until now." According to Medical Express, lead poisoning has a far greater impact on global health than previously thought, potentially contributing to over 5 million deaths a year and posing a similar threat to air pollution, modeling research suggested. The study, described as a wake-up call, also estimated that exposure to the toxic metal causes young children in developing countries to lose an average of nearly 6 IQ points each. Lead pollution has been shown to cause a range of serious health problems, particularly relating to heart disease, and the brain development of small children, resulting in leaded gasoline being banned worldwide. But people can still be exposed to the potent neurotoxin via food, soil, cookware, fertilizers, cosmetics, lead acid, car batteries, and other sources.
Welcome back to Aperture. In the first part of the program, we witnessed that abuse by law enforcement officers in the United States is one of the most serious and divisive human rights violations in the country, as U.S. police is killing black people at persistently high rates. What is clear is that racism is at the very heart of the issue, as statistics show that black people are 3 times more likely to be killed by police than white people. What is worse is that even black children are being targeted. Yet the people have not been silent. They have organized in what is known as the Black Lives Matter campaign to get the message across that all lives are of equal value, no matter the color of the skin. Stay with us for the rest of the program.
We're just going over some things for the vigil. It's going to be in Nicholas Hayward Jr. Park. That's in Brooklyn. He was murdered by the police, 13-year-old murdered by the police for like really similar circumstances, very close parallel to what was happening with what happened with Tamir Rice. So it's important for me, I think, that that place be chosen and that his story be highlighted. So to that end, I'm always trying to connect the dots so that people see, yes, this is a national issue, but this is also a local issue. So his father's going to be speaking. We'll have a prayer by Pastor Omar, words from Mr. Hayward, and then I'll close out talking about the national epidemic of police violence against children. And this is why I wanted us to meet, so that we could talk about things that I may be overlooking. Well, for one, I've applied for a pit permit with the Parks Department. You guys know that's always important to me, but I also wanted to get your input on that. We had issues with the permit with the march, lots of fighting with the Parks Department and the Police Department. And so they haven't been responsive yet, so I'm wondering if we're going to encounter the same issues that we did with the 4-mile march. The reason why I choose places of public accommodation is because we have a legal right to be there. And so, like, you know, there's nothing that they can really do about us exercising our First Amendment right within a space of public accommodation.
I'm really glad that the weather held up.
Thank God, because yesterday was terrible.
Yeah, I thought it was going to rain.
Imagine if yesterday would have been today.
Yeah, and lugging all of this stuff in the rain, and I know it would have been a terrible turnout.
Just get ponchos.
Yeah. Exactly. But, you know, people don't show up when it's rainy or cold, so I'm really glad that people have, you know, I think we're going to have a good turnout.
So I'm really excited working with Leah because, you know, you saw her. She's going to be having the weatherproof posters of the children and their stories.
She did a great job.
I think that'll be powerful with it tied, like, on the fence so that passerbys, you know, will wonder and come and look, and then they can read the stories.
I'm excited about that. She also did an art installation on the floor where she got age-appropriate shoes, like the whatever size of shoe size would be at the age that they were killed, and she painted those white, and those are going to be there too. So it's going to really help you visualize how small these kids were when their lives were stolen.
And I think it's good to focus on the children, because this is something that can't be argued. Like,
exactly.
Even you can play devil's advocate, but these are children.
Exactly.
Children are harmless. So.
In September 1994, Nicholas Hayward Jr. was shot and killed in a public housing stairwell by an NYPD officer who mistook a plastic toy gun for a real one. Hayward was just 13 years old. Like so many other cases, no one was indicted in connection with the killing. In the 22 years since Hayward's death, his father has struggled with how and why his son died.
I cry a lot. It's hard to deal with losing a loved one. Nicholas was 13 years old. It pains me every time I hear of another victim being killed. My son was a great kid. He wasn't causing any harm to anyone. He was doing the right things. You know, he wasn't a danger or a threat to the officer that killed him. So, I mean, I feel that this is something that I have to do. I have to do this.
We live in a society that continues to criminalize our youth, despite the fact how much effort they put forward to try to make their own life better. My son was doing the best that he can prior to him being killed. And he told the officer, we're only playing. And he shot and killed Nicholas in mid-sentence. And despite all of the witnesses who's basically justified what Nicholas was doing, that he dropped the toy gun. They all told the district attorney he dropped the toy gun and the officer shot him anyway.
I think that actually there is a culture in police departments to protect each other, so that when they engage in the use of arbitrary power, they come together in the code of silence and refuse to allow us to find out exactly what goes on. I think they also have intimate connections to the judges and others. But I would say this, though, there's no doubt in my mind that there was an epidemic of shooting of precious, well-to-do white brothers and sisters. Police would be accountable. So even given the culture of the police departments that make it difficult for accountability to take place, it's also the fact that when it comes to poor black and brown peoples, that their lives matter less than the lives of well-to-do whites. And therefore, we have to make sure that there's fair policing rather than arbitrary policing. I think fair policing is police having a relationship with the community in which they're an organic part of that community. They are fighting crime. There's all kinds of forms of criminality, including criminality in the black community, criminality in Wall Street, criminality in professional circles and so forth. But police, unfortunately, over the years, have engaged in such massive arbitrary uses of power that the distrust cuts very, very deep. And of course, it's the backdrop of wealth inequality. It's a backdrop of a capitalist system that makes it very difficult for working peoples of any color to have their humanity affirmed. It's the backdrop of a system in which the opportunities are so limited, the decrepit school system, the massive unemployment, as well as massive underemployment. So we can't overlook the larger social context of the policing that goes on in America. But it can be much more fair than it is now.
A state of emergency has been declared in the U.S. city of Baltimore after protesters clashed with police. It follows the funeral of Freddie Gray, who died in police custody over a week ago. The National Guard say that as many as 5,000 troops have been deployed amid the unrest.
Basically, since Monday, there's been a lot of speculation about what's going on out there, but basically, Freddie Gray, as we remember, we don't know why he was arrested, but he was stopped and he was arrested. And under police custody, his spine ended up being broken and he died from his injuries. So we just need to figure out what's going on, because there's a lot of things being said. We don't know if the youth, we don't know what's going on. We know that a CVS was destroyed. But, I mean, with the state of the Baltimore that I knew, I don't imagine that it could be much different from how it used to be. So I am going to head out there, see what's going on, see what I can learn from it, see how I can help, how I can support, but I just can't stay here in New York and not do anything at this point. So I'm heading out there.
Breaking news from Baltimore, a city on edge since the death of a suspect while in police custody, his spine nearly severed. Tonight, those tensions fueling violent protests now. Dramatic images coming in at this hour. You can see some people on the streets there throwing rocks and bricks at police officers.
On April 19th, 2015, 23-year-old Freddie Gray Jr., an African-American man, died in a Baltimore hospital after sustaining injuries while being transported in a police van. Gray had been arrested a week before by the Baltimore Police Department for possessing what the police said was an illegal switchblade. Gray's hospitalization and subsequent death resulted in an ongoing series of protests. On April 25th, 2015, a major protest in downtown Baltimore turned violent, resulting in 34 arrests and injuries to 15 police officers. After Gray's funeral on April 27th, civil disorder intensified with the looting and burning of local businesses and a drugstore, resulting in a state of emergency declared by Maryland Governor Larry Hogan. The Maryland National Guard was deployed to Baltimore, and a curfew was put into place.
I went there expecting the worst because I had seen the National Guard on TV and I had seen like how occupied they were by the military. So I was a little nervous when I got there, but surprisingly, it seemed that they were protecting mostly the harbor, the downtown harbor. That's where all of the National Guard really was, and it seemed that that was what their attention was focused on protecting. I think the media tried to kind of instill fear so that the same thing wouldn't happen in New York. But with Baltimore, it was the young children not feeling heard. It was mostly young children. All of the programs out there are cut for them. There's really nothing for them after school or part-time job-wise out there. So these children, they felt unheard, and their thing was to take to the streets. They were emotional. They started destroying, you know, things that they didn't feel were beneficial to the community.
The narrative around Baltimore, first of all, was that it was a riot. And I don't like that terminology because it's an uprising. It's cause and effect. When people are living in pervasive poverty and homelessness and joblessness, and on top of that, you add to that the current political climate where we see, not that it wasn't happening before, but where we see an overabundance of cops shooting and killing unarmed men, that was a natural response to those conditions. As with every other protest that has happened throughout this country in response to this issue, there was a negative slant put on it. They wanted to paint these people as savages instead of looking at the cause and effect. And they also didn't focus on the days that preceded what they call the riot, where people were actually in the streets peacefully protesting. So, of course, they're gonna spin it.
On May 21st, a grand jury indicted several of the officers involved with Gray's arrest. But in December 2015, a Baltimore judge declared a mistrial in the trial of one officer after the jury was unable to reach a verdict. The images of police wearing helmets and masks, toting assault rifles, and riding in mine-resistant armored vehicles in Baltimore and Ferguson has also raised widespread criticism of what has been dubbed the militarization of local police forces.
Difference, I think, in the last 5 or 10 years, you've got the intense militarization of police departments. So the police department still engaged in arbitrary policing when I was growing up, but they didn't have the military equipment that they have now. And the very fact that the last 10 years or so, every 28 hours, there's a black or brown person who's killed by a police or security guard.
I think that military-grade equipment should be allocated to police department, but never, ever used against civilians. The military-grade equipment should be used in active shooter situation, terrorist attack, but never against a civilian unrest. And I, in my mind, it was a horrible error of judgment.
We need action. By action, I mean transformation of institutions. By action, I mean redistribution of the wealth downward. By action, action, I mean high-quality jobs, high-quality education. By action, I mean high-quality communities where people can live with dignity. By action, I mean police who are accountable, who are punished by law if they murder other folk, arbitrarily treat other folk in ways in which they ought not. So we're talking about just radical democracy. We need people's power, we need the sharing of power.
Unfortunately, I think that what we've seen with the killings of the officers in New York in 2014 and what we've seen in Dallas recently, unfortunately, I think that this is not the end of retaliation against law enforcement officers by certain individuals who feel that police profession and officers, no matter what department they come from, represent this oppressive and brutal treatment of minorities. After all, if somebody thinks about democracy and democratic principle and wanting to live in a democratic country, they have to realize that policing is a pillar of democracy. And if there are issues of concern, these issues of concern have to be discussed and have to be brought to the attention of the local politicians. But never, ever, they should be translated into any violent behavior, especially towards the ones who overall are charged with the protection of all of us.
One major goal that we have is to tie federal funding of local police forces to a prerequisite that they provide data regarding their shootings, especially in the cases of when they're shooting unarmed civilians, and then also to tie that to the mandatory use of body cameras. So that's a huge goal because I think transparency is necessary. I don't think there's enough data out there, and so that's another reason why people are able to dismiss this issue. Another goal is to have an independent prosecutor to prosecute police when in cases of police violence, especially against unarmed people, because I think it will restore faith for those of us who have lost it in our criminal justice system. People believe that the grand jury system is antiquated and leaves police to kill with impunity. And so I think that this would be one way to help resolve that issue.
You know, a lot of people ask me, like, why do I protest? And because it's an ongoing problem, and I can pretend that it's not going on. I can pretend that it's not happening, but there will be a new hashtag to learn. There'll be a new face the next day. And so we continue to march and move forward and get more organized and get serious, because I don't want my children to still be marching. My grandparents marched. My mother was involved in activism work. And so I don't want to pass this along. I want to be able to tell them the story of how we overcame, how we were able to come together and fight this greater evil, and just, I don't want my children to experience it. You know, I don't want them to grow up being afraid or teaching them to be afraid of police.
You don't know when the catalyst will be in place. Why did Rosa Parks become the catalyst as opposed to the earlier black woman who sat down on the bus just a few months earlier? It's hard to say when the spark in place takes off, the fire begins to expand, intensifies, and next thing you know, you got a whole host of people on fire for justice. And lo and behold, people take off and it becomes contagious. You don't know when it's going to become contagious. It is contagious now. We are still living in the moment of Ferguson, Baltimore, and things will continue and I hope intensify.
I was told that I'm an activist from the way that I've been doing. I never thought I would be doing this type of work. I've never been the talkative type of person, this outspoken, but this made me who I am. And, you know, this is my life mission right now, like, to become an activist, become a civil rights lawyer, you know, to bring justice some way, somehow, to America. This helps me. This helps me a lot. Speaking to people and being out here is more of a support than, you know, shutting down or just crying all the time. I believe that the reforms is going to happen, but I believe that it's going to take a long time. It's going to take a lot of powerful people to be on the same page. What do I fear the most? That when my daughter get older, this will still be going on with no change.
Black Lives Matter is a multiracial movement. Because if black lives matter, given the depth of white supremacy in America, then all lives will matter. Because usually it's the black lives that are the last ones that have value. But the indigenous lives will matter, the Asian lives, the white lives, the brown lives, if black lives matter. That's what makes that movement so crucial. And I'm just so very proud and blessed to be an old school brother who's a small part of that movement led by young folk.
Well, for now, it seems that police brutality and racial injustice is not going to stop in the U.S. in the near future. And statistics show that many black Americans are skeptical that their country will ever make the changes necessary for racial equality. Perhaps only time will tell if America will ever be the land of the free. And that's a wrap for this week. Hope you will join us next week for another program here on Aperture. Goodbye for now.
Your option, our task. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio. In the limelight.
A new study says microplastics infiltrate all systems of mammals' bodies, including the brain, causing behavioral changes. The research involved exposing young and old mice to varying levels of microplastics in drinking water over the course of 3 weeks. Synthetic textiles such as polyester and nylon are a leading source of microplastic pollution, which has been identified worldwide from the peak of Mount Everest to uninhabited Antarctica. Regarding this issue, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Vion wrote, microplastics are already a health scare, and a number of studies are being carried out to determine the extent of the damage they cause to our bodies. A new study has painted an even scarier picture. An experiment on mice has revealed that microplastics introduced through drinking water accumulated in almost every part of the mammal's bodies, even the brain. These mice even showed behavioral changes which were similar to dementia in humans. The study has pointed at a scary possibility that microplastics are breaching the immune barrier between the rest of the body and nervous system to enter the brain. The study was carried out by experts at the University of Rhode Island and published in International Journal of Molecular Science. To us, this was striking. These were not high doses of microplastics, but in only a short period of time, we saw these changes, explains neuroscientist Jamie Ross, as quoted on the University of Rhode Island website, adding, nobody really understands the life cycle of these microplastics in the body, so part of what we want to address is the question of what happens as you get older. Are you more susceptible to systematic inflammation from these microplastics as you age? Can your body get rid of them as easily? Do your cells respond differently to these toxins? It is not a given that results obtained in experiments with mice would directly point at possible effects on humans, but such a study is often the first step to subsequently determine how humans are affected. In this experiment, young and old mice were given water treated with microplastics, which were made of fluorescent polystyrene. Some of the mice were given normal water to establish a reference point. It was a 3-week trial. The behavior of the mice was regularly monitored during open field tests. These tests encouraged exploratory behavior. As compared to the control group of mice, which was given normal water to drink, the mice who drank microplastic-contaminated water for the duration of 3 weeks reportedly showed significant behavioral changes. Older mice seemed to exhibit these changes to a greater degree. After 3 weeks, it was found that microplastics were present in every type of tissues of the mice that the team examined. The organs included liver, kidney, heart, spleen, lungs, and most importantly, brain. The microplastics were even found in the excrements of the mice. The website of Science Alert also wrote, scientists investigating the possible health effects of microplastics have uncovered some disturbing initial results in an experiment based on mice. When old and young rodents drank microplastic fragments of plastic suspended in their water over a course of 3 weeks, researchers at the University of Rhode Island found traces of pollutants had accumulated in every organ of the tiny mammal's body, including the brain. The presence of these microplastics was also accompanied by behavioral changes akin to dementia in humans, as well as changes to immune markers in the liver and brain. Recently, scientists have found microplastics hiding in the human intestine, circulating in our bloodstream, gathering deep in the lungs and seeping through to the placenta. In 2021, toxicologists warned that future studies urgently need to address what these pollutants are doing to our health, especially since exposure is now all but impossible to avoid. In 2022, a similar study also found that ingested polystyrene microplastics can accumulate in the brains of mice, triggering inflammation and impairing their memory. This study did not, however, identify any behavioral changes among mice during an open field test. Despite the discrepancies between results, Ross and her colleagues argue it is now evident polystyrene microplastics can travel to the mammal brain and exert detrimental effects after absorption. In their recent study, they found a protein called GFAP, which supports cells in the brain, had increased in abundance following the ingestion of microplastics. Ross says a decrease in GFAP has been associated with early stages of some neurodegenerative diseases, including mouse models of Alzheimer's disease, as well as depression. We were very surprised to see that the microplastics could induce altered GFAP signaling. Ross plans to investigate these concerning changes in future research. The study was published in the International Journal of Molecular Science.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
The UN Migration Agency